Welcome back to another episode of B-Hall Radio. I'm your host, Brian Rowan. We're on episode 82. We've got Jordan Tom co-hosting tonight. Welcome to the show, Jordan.
What's up, B-Hall fam?
Hey, how's it going? We got a really special one tonight. Tonight, we've got Major General retired Mike Nardotti Jr. He's a very famous Army wrestler, 1969 graduate, four-year starter, NCAA All-American. Served as an infantry officer in Vietnam, later inducted into the U.S. Army Ranger Hall of Fame. Served for 28 years, culminating as the Judge Advocate General of the Army. Among many other accolades, he is the recipient of the Distinguished Service Medal, Silver Star, and Purple Heart. Following his military career, Mr. Nardotti became a partner in the law firm of Squire Patton Boggs, based out of Washington, D.C., where he resides currently. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I'm excited. This has been a long time coming, so it's been good getting to know you a little bit before the show, and I'm excited to go live now.
I really, really appreciate this opportunity to talk about Army wrestling.
Yeah, I mean, it's
Army wrestling in the old days.
Well, it'll be great to see tie some similarities to kind of the cultures of the past, and you know, hear your story, get into West Point. But before we do all that, you know, kind of want to talk, you know, you retired recently here in the last couple of years. So how are you enjoying retirement? What's going on? Are you staying busy?
We're enjoying it very much. I had retired from my law firm in 2017, but I had one unresolved veteran pro bono case. And it actually took until 2021 to get that resolved. So I was I was special counsel to the law firm. I was a partner for 20 years, from 97 to 2017. And then an additional 4 years as special counsel to try to resolve that case. And fortunately, we were able to get that resolved favorably for the officer involved. And since that time, I have been fully retired from work. Now, I also, one of the things I did, and even though I was working part-time, I did some theology studies. Not for degree purposes, but just to get deeper into my faith. I'm a Catholic. And I did that for about 3 years. I took it as far as I could without learning Greek and Latin. It worked out just fine. But right now, my wife and I are trying to do as much traveling as we can. We have the ability to do that. We're both physically able to do the traveling. We've got 9 grandchildren. Six live locally, and we have 2 in Asheville, North Carolina. Actually, the 2 oldest are in University of Tennessee now. And we just had our ninth grandchild was born this summer. So between our international travel and going to Asheville and chasing the grandkids around to sporting events here in Virginia, we're keeping ourselves busy and we're enjoying life.
Yeah, you got a lot going on. Where's the best place you've traveled since you've retired?
Since we just got back this year, this summer, my West Point class, 69, is a very tight class. And we've done one of the things we decided a number of years ago is that, you know, you had the formal reunions every 5 years. Sure. And when you get to the age where you're not sure you're going to make it 5 years down the road, someone came up with the idea of doing mini reunions in the in-between years. And we had a couple of mini reunions this year. We went out to the Eastern Shore. That was kind of a local one, but we also had a cruise on the Elbe River between Berlin and Prague. Wow. We had a number of classmates on that. We leave Sunday for another Berlin to Prague, and then we went to the Passion Play in Oberammergau with 2 other couples. My wife and I and the family went to Greece. My son's wife, her mother lives in Greece, so we spent about a month in Greece. And then on Sunday, we take off for another mini reunion trip. We're going to go to fly to Venice, and we're going to be on the on a boat that goes down the Dalmatian coast. So we'll go to Slovenia, Croatia, Montenegro, then Corfu in Greece, Santorini, and we'll be around to we'll finish in Athens. And then we have another for 2023. We have another cruise lined up for the class mini reunion cruise. That's going to be on the Seine River. Between Paris and Normandy. But in the past, we've been to the Galapagos with classmates. We've been on a tour of the Douro River from Porto, Portugal, into Spain. We have done a cruise on the Baltic Sea. We also went to Africa with three other couples. So we've been
all over the place,
making the rounds.
Yeah, the ideas are floating. I'm like, man, I need to figure out how to retire younger so I can go to all these places too. I'm dreading retirement a little bit because it's like, what are you going to do? But now you're giving me all these ideas. You could just travel, you know, all the time.
Yeah, when you don't have a schedule to keep it, it works.
That's awesome. Well, you talked about being close with your classmates. Did you have a desire growing up to go to West Point? Talk about, you know, obviously one of the vehicles that got you there was wrestling. Talk about growing up and wrestling and what made you make the decision to end up eventually going to West Point.
Well, in growing up in the 1950s and early 60s, the attitude toward the military was one of great respect. And certainly for those who attended the military academy and the Naval Academy, they were well respected. There was actually a couple of TV shows on Men of West Point and a weekly series, and then Men of Annapolis, and they were popular during their time. You know, we were children of my generation were children of the World War II generation. The idea of service and certainly respect for the military was high on the priority list. In my high school, when I got to my high school on Long Island, there were about five guys who had actually gone to the Naval Academy. Mm-hmm. No one had ever gone to the military academy, and it was really kind of odd because Navy, both in football and in wrestling, recruited very heavily on Long Island, and were visible. Army didn't do that. I got to know the wrestling coach from Navy, Ed Perry, very well, and my high school wrestling coach was really partial to Navy, and he was hoping that I would go to the Naval Academy. And I did get an appointment to the Naval Academy from Senator Jacob Javits in New York, but I thought it over very carefully, and I decided that I was trying to think past the academy. I think I concluded pretty early that going to either place, either the Naval Academy or the Military Academy, you get a first class education. There was no question about that. My question was, you know, here you are making a commitment for the next 9 years. You're 18 years old and you're making a commitment for the next 9 years, right? Four at West Point, and then you're going to, or four at an academy, and then you're five, you know, in a service. And I concluded that the Navy was not for me. And I had to try to get a better feel for what I was getting into. A friend of my sister had a brother who had gone to West Point, and he'd been out about 10 years, class of 57. He was teaching at West Point, and he would come home to Long Island to visit his mother on occasion. And I asked if it would be possible for me to speak with him about the Army, not so much about West Point, but about the Army. And he was more than willing to chat with me about it. We talked about it, what he had done. He'd been to Vietnam. He'd been out in the field, and now he was teaching at West Point. And after speaking with him, I was satisfied that really, I think the Army was the right fit for me. If I'd gone to the Naval Academy, I would have been a Marine, I'm sure. I would not have been a surface guy or an aviator, but I still would have been on boats. I think the Army was a better fit for me. I guess I got to know West Point a little bit better than Navy because our varsity club made a trip up there. And I remember one of the, I think it was the athletic director, we had a group and they were talking to us about West Point. And the athletic director said to somebody, he said, you know, you really wouldn't make a mistake by going to a place like this. And I've always felt that way about it, even after, you know, when I made the decision to go, that you know, if you go there and you take advantage of all the opportunity that's there, and you listen and learn, you're going to have a first-class educational experience, more than you would get at another college. So I had, at the time that, and when I graduated high school, when I, before I graduated, I had the appointment to Naval Academy. I also had scholarships to Lehigh and to Dartmouth. An interesting aspect of me getting into West Point was I was being considered for West Point by my local congressman, John Weidler, and I was being considered for Annapolis by the state senator, Jacob Javits. Well, Javits came through with a second alternate for me to the Naval Academy pretty quickly. And Weidler's rule was if you got an appointment to any academy, whatever the nomination was, mm-hmm. alternate or otherwise, he would drop you from consideration. So my local congressman dropped me. Oh. Well, this is where the wrestling made the difference, because Leroy Alitz was able to, you know, I was in this basket of the qualified alternates, and you're fully qualified to get in, but you need an appointment. And what they do, the way the process worked at that time, is they would look for unused appointments. And I wound up being appointed to West Point by Adam Clayton Powell of the 18th Congressional District in New York City. He was one of about four African-American members of Congress at the time. Hmm. So that I've pointed that out to, you know, in these days of equity and inclusion and diversity. And when I was in the JAG Corps and we were trying to increase our minority recruiting, going out to get minority lawyers, I said, you know, you never know where your opportunities are going to come from. And I was a prime example. It just happened that congressman was not using his appointments, and they were able to use that to get me an opportunity that I was really wanted, and I was prepared for.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's funny when we talk with some of the guys around your time frame, you know, take for granted how much is out there in terms of education around what West Point is and what you're going to be doing and what's expected of you, right? I mean, there's movies and TV shows. You can Google it. You can go on YouTube, all these different things. And that wasn't available to you at the time. I remember Mr. Steenlitz saying something about, you know, he had never even visited West Point. The first time he saw it was the day he showed up. And that was the case for a lot of folks. So very cool to hear about how you got there, and definitely wrestling paid a piece. So glad to have you part of the brotherhood here.
Yeah, I find it really interesting. You know, I always knew that the public perception at that point, you know, that was not very high of the military, but I didn't realize that West Point and Annapolis were very different in that, you know, they were still very respected. I just assumed that there was kind of that same opinion in the academies as well.
Let me make sure I'm clear on that. The respect for the military at that time was very high, as the military generally, as well as West Point and Annapolis. We hadn't reached a stage where things were going downhill for the services. And it was interesting because when I went into, and one of the questions you had noted this, that the Vietnam War was going at full strength for those 4 years that we were there. And it was what was an interesting, the most interesting aspect of that experience was that I can remember one of the last times I went to the beach before I reported for West Point on the 1st of July was reading an editorial in the New York Times, which at that time was considered the nation's newspaper, and was very supportive of the effort in Vietnam. Of course, by the time we graduated, that had flipped 180 degrees, and public support for the war, even as it continued to rage, had changed dramatically, which made it, and that was a time where veterans returning from Vietnam were not treated very well. Bob Steenlitz explained some of that in his interview. So that was, you know, that I think it had a lot of people questioning, you know, where are we headed? What are we doing? My feeling at the time, I still feel this way, that, you know, I took advantage of the opportunity to go to West Point and get a first class education. And the due out on that was 5 years of service. And at that time, there was still a draft in effect. The draft was in effect till about 1973. So I knew there were people in Vietnam, there were soldiers in Vietnam who probably would have been, some had enlisted, but others were drafted. And I thought I owed it to them as well as to the nation generally to do my duty and go to Vietnam. And I volunteered, and it was, I will say, the most important service of my life was leading men in combat. And I think that as I look back on things, West Point, the experience at West Point taught me things that I just would not have learned at any other institution, perhaps at another academy, but I think West Point at that time was unique. And I've been able to follow the leadership development program West Point over the years. I've had the opportunity to sit on a couple of task force and committees that looked at the academies. And I think the academies, and particularly West Point, has done an extraordinarily good job at evolving the leadership development program in a very positive way. I would agree wholeheartedly with what Bob Steenley said in his interview about some of the abuses that took place under the old fourth class system. And I never understood the philosophy of guys who thought they needed to make it so tough on plebes. I was wondering, what did you learn the last 3 years at West Point? Shouldn't it get progressively tougher? Shouldn't it be more responsibility on you? Why are you putting so much pressure on the plebes? And, you know, certainly there's a weeding out process, because there are people who come in, certainly at that time, who didn't know what they were getting into and probably should have been going someplace else anyway. But a system like that was susceptible to abuse, and there was abuse. And it took some great courage to change that, because when you're facing the old grads who, you know, have made it through, and they, you know, they don't want to see that, they want the core to remain as tough as it always was. You know, and they think it's gotten softer. And in my opinion, it hasn't. I think it's gotten more demanding over the years in terms of the academic disciplines and the requirements, the physical requirements, athletics and military training, all has gotten better. So I've been very, very impressed and pleased with what I've seen. And I'm very proud of West Point for being able to make the changes that needed to be made to develop leaders in the most effective way. I think it is, I truly believe it's the most effective, the best leadership development institution in the world. I think that the product speaks for itself when you see what graduates have done at their first class. And I'm sure I'd feel that way at the other academies as well, but I'm biased, so.
Well, I'd agree with you as well. You know, you talked a little about, you know, kind of your time at West Point, you know, and I'm really interested, you know, you mentioned troops had started in Vietnam when you were as a plebe, and then progressed as you went throughout. How did the training at West Point change, you know, from a military perspective through, you know, as we were in conflict? Do you recall that, or can you go into detail about that?
I think one of the errors that the Army made generally early on is, you know, the tendency to fight like you fought the last war. So I think early on for the Army, they weren't adjusting to the tactics that had to be adapted in the jungle. I think at the time that I was at West Point, we were trained, our Fort Buckner, Camp Buckner experience was with the with troops from the 82nd Airborne Division. I think we had the 101st during our plebe summer out there where they did the Recondo training. And it was good as far as it went, but I think our expectation, certainly mine, was that the real training, you know, we knew that if you were going to, in those days, if you went in the infantry, you were going to go to Ranger School. And I fully expected that the training in Ranger School would be the most important training that I would receive before I went to Vietnam. And it turned out to be the case. I think that, you know, West Point, you know, the way they have balanced things today is it makes it as good as you can make it. But I think you can only go so far at the academy. Then when you choose your branch, you have to do your branch training. And then if you're in those days, if you were infantry, most times you'd go airborne and ranger as well. That's not necessarily the case these days. I think they try to be more discriminating on who they're going to send to ranger school. And again, in those days too, we didn't have the Ranger battalions. The concept in those days when you went to Ranger school was that you would be trained in the Ranger skills and then you take that onto your unit and help train your unit. But as I said, I'm repeating this, but it's important that training that we had in Ranger school was the most important preparation that I had to be a platoon leader in Vietnam. And I think, let me say, make this other point too, because I think it is important. And this is one of the things that differentiates the West Point education from others. Part of the West Point education is that in your experience, you're going to be responsible for other people. You become, you learn to follow as a plebe. But as a yearling cow and as a firstie, you're going to be responsible for other people. As a, you have a team leader as a yearling. You're going to be a squad leader as a cow, and then you're going to be a company commander or higher. And if you look around other institutions, where are there institutions where they expect one level of student to be responsible professional development of younger students? You don't find that to me. And I know there are ROTC programs and there are other things that may skim the surface, but not like at West Point. And I think that having that experience makes a very, very significant difference. And I will tell you that I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, but when I got to private practice, a number of, there weren't many, there were no retired general officers in the law firm that I went to, or retired officers at all. I was the first of it. They had a number of veterans there because those were people who still came out of the draft. But after I came in, there were a number of younger judge advocates who came in, and they were cut above of their contemporaries. And I, even though, you know, I said this many times that, you know, you can take somebody out of Harvard Law School or Yale, and they may be really bright, but one thing that they haven't had in the course of their education is the opportunity to be responsible for other people, to train them, to look out for their welfare, to make sure they're on the right track. In the military, you get that. If you're an officer, you're going to get that. If you're an NCO, you're going to get that. And that experience is, you can't put a dollar value on that kind of experience. And it makes all the difference when you're trying to organize, in a way to deal with solving problems. How do you motivate people? How do you make sure that they've got the skills that they need to do those things? But that, again, going back to West Point, you're learning that as you go through it, in addition to the academics that you have, which are very demanding, you're going to have this other experience as well.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I've recently transitioned out of the military in the last 2 years, and I've seen a difference in my personal life, right? just the things that West Point taught me from a leadership standpoint. But I also think there was things that wrestling specifically at West Point, when I think about folks that were on the wrestling team versus folks that weren't, right? And there's some other folks from different sports that probably fall into the same category. Mm-hmm. But there's particular things that I learned being an Army wrestler of, you know, around just toughness and grittiness and hard work and discipline that I think probably even put you another cut above maybe just, in my opinion, right? Maybe the average cadet. And I'm curious, right, your time as a wrestler, do you think that there was particular disciplines or aspects that you learned from being on the wrestling team? Just kind of curious about hearing about your time as a wrestler specifically, if you want to talk any funny stories or anybody like that, that'd be good to hear.
Yeah, I think that is very true. And let me talk about this first, and not the West Point experience, but my experience as a grandfather. My grandson started wrestling. He was kind of drafted because he was a lightweight in his high school. He never wrestled before. And it was a real learning experience for him. And he wrestled all 4 years. And I told him hundreds of times, I can't tell you how proud I am of you, because in this sport, unlike so many others, right. You know, you go out there on the mat and you're on your own. If you win, it's your victory. If you lose, it's, you know, your loss, and it's in front of everybody. And that takes a level of guts that, you know, those who play team sports don't understand. Not that it's not great to be a team sport, but when you have to go out and do that. And I think that I don't think I fully appreciated that early on in wrestling. I definitely learned it pretty quickly. you know, when you you rise and fall on your own merits. And I think that because it's on an individual, but you know, the team may do very well and you might have gotten your butt kicked in a match, and you know, you've got to recover from that real quickly. And I think there are important lessons in life for life is full of ups and downs. I don't mean to be trite about it, but it's true. I mean, you have successes and failures every day. And, you know, how do you deal with those? Are you going to bury your head and not try to do your best again? Of course not. And that's what you have to learn in wrestling. That's what I tell my grandson. We had a bad match. Said, you gotta let go of that really quickly. You got another match coming up if you're in a tournament. And I think he learned to appreciate that. I should tell you, I didn't mention this in any of the, we didn't talk about this earlier, but I have to tell you about the probably the worst match I had in my entire wrestling career, high school and college. And I had, in those days, we didn't wrestle 30 dual meets a year. We did about 10 or 12 dual meets. We would have, when we went home for Christmas, I would go to a local tournament. CW Post on Long Island had a tournament, and some of the, you know, the other guys who went home would do that. So we weren't wrestling 30, 40, 50 matches a year. But I had, and we were, when you say it was a 4 year start, I want to clarify. We had a plebe team. I was on the plebe team, started on the plebe team. And then there were three, you were not eligible as a freshman, as a plebe, for varsity in those days. So I was a 3 year starter in the varsity. As a sophomore, as a yearling, I was in the same weight class as the team captain. And I had to beat the team captain to get into the lineup. And we, you know, did a 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 4. I don't know what it was, but basically I was able to get in the lineup. And so I had some good matches as a yearling. And one of the matches I had was in Springfield against a guy who had been the captain of the team, New England champ. And I beat him 3-1 on a very close call on the edge of the mat, on a takedown on the edge of the mat. That's as a, here I am, a yearling. So go fast forward 2 years. I'm a firstie, senior. And I hadn't lost a dual meet in 2 years. Now, I had only wrestled about 10 each year, but I hadn't lost a dual meet in 2 years. And we're wrestling Springfield. And this guy that I had beaten on a tough call is one of the coaches. Well, I wrestle a guy, a freshman from Springfield, and went out and took him down right away. But then the bottom fell out, and Coach Alex was furious at the referee because the referee started. He warned me for stalling and then kind of got very aggressive with stalling. And by the time we ended the second period, I was down 7-2. And he had warned me for stalling and did 1 point, 1 point, 2 points. So I had four, he had 4 points. The other guy had 4 points on stalling. I was on the verge of being disqualified for stalling. I had a furious comeback in the third period. Score ends up 9-9, but he had riding time, so I lose 10-9. to a freshman. So that, you know, this is kind of what goes around comes around, you know, the,
yeah,
yeah, I beat the guy who's now a coach and one of his freshmen beats me. I was a regimental commander, cadet regimental commander. My officer regimental commander was sitting in the stands watching this. His name was, it was Colonel Ralph Puckett. I don't know if that name has any familiarity to you, but he was, just a little bit of background. He came to, when he came to be the regimental commander, he was a class of 49, a Korean War veteran. He formed one of the first Ranger companies to go to Korea, formed it in Japan, took it to Japan, was seriously wounded, very seriously wounded and highly decorated in Korea and Vietnam, battalion commander, seriously wounded, wounded again and highly decorated. He, last year, if you were to read his citation, he got a distinguished service, a distinguished service cross in Korea. If you read the citation, you'd probably scratch your head and say, why wasn't this a Medal of Honor? Mm-hmm. As it turned out, 70 years later, after the efforts of some distinguished other distinguished soldiers, his distinguished service cross was upgraded to a Medal of Honor.
Wow.
And in a ceremony last year in 2021, the White House. So this is the guy that's my mentor. He was my most important mentor at West Point. I lost the match and he sent me a note the next day. And he said, there's nothing that I can tell you that's going to make you feel any better about your match yesterday. He said, but I will tell you that you and indeed every ounce of the determination that you showed in the third period when you go to Ranger School next year. And he was right. Ranger School was the most demanding experience, physical experience I'd been through. Mm. The fact that I had wrestled, in fact, it was kind of humorous in Ranger School at the time. You'd spend the first third of the course at Fort Benning, and then you go to the mountains for the second third. And the third, the last part of it, you're at in Florida. And in Florida, they started cutting back on your rations. So here we are with a number of classmates, you know, all good soldiers, you know, good, you know, good cadets, but they had never had to skip a meal.
Never skipped a meal in their life. That's right.
Wrestlers are going through this. They're kind of laughing about. So we don't have as much to eat today. What's new?
Yeah, more of the same. That's right.
Yeah. But he was right about that experience. And that, as I said, turned out to be the most important experience that I had before I went to Vietnam, to prepare me for Vietnam. So
was that match and that experience of him telling you, or Ranger School, sorry?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
That match was that match critical, or was there parts of wrestling that then prepared you for Ranger School?
Because I think what was critical was what my regimental commander told me.
Yeah.
You know, I made a furious comeback. It wasn't enough, but I gave it a hell of a shot, and he saw that, and he pointed me in a direction where I could use that in the future, remember that in the future. I think one of the, you know, at the time when we went, at the time that we were at the academy, all plebes had to take boxing, wrestling, swimming, and gymnastics. And I think the Corps generally had a pretty healthy respect for wrestling, because most of the cadets had not wrestled. And to go through that experience, even in a, you know, in a physical education class, you get an idea of how tough the sport is. And I know that's not required now. It's too bad, because I think it's for the good of the sport at West Point. If more people had to do it or subject to it, they would appreciate how tough that is.
Yeah, I wish they had it now. I think when people wrestle and have never wrestled before, they get very surprised how quick you can get tired in like 30 seconds. Like they don't appreciate like, oh, you only wrestle for 6 minutes or 7 minutes. Like I could do that. I don't know if Heskett did it, but I know Coach Ward does it. Now he'll have the tacks come into the wrestling room for like PT and then put them through like a wrestling workout. Like either, you know, before the season or during the season, it's kind of like an introduction to like meet the coaching staff, but also to give them like a, hey, like, you know, when our wrestlers have practice in the morning, like this is what they're doing. They're not getting out of, you know, breakfast or sleeping in, like this is what they're doing. So respect that. I'd like to dive also more into like kind of like the culture of the wrestling program back when you were there. I mean, we talk a lot about it on this podcast, you know, but, you know, I know you talked about Mr. Steenlich, you know, quite a bit. You know, he was a firstie when you were a plea. Were there any other wrestlers that stood out, or, you know, as you're, you know, going through the years, who, you know, you remember fondly or keep in touch with?
I had a couple of classmates that wrestled, one in particular, Greg Smith. We've been on a couple of trips together, you know, with other classmates. But actually, a number have come back to some of the reunions. Mark Hoffman, who was 152 pounder, has done very well in business out on the West Coast. Seen, you know, I don't see them with regularity, but when the opportunity arises, you know, for reunions and other things, we get together. I have to say that the strongest impression I have in terms of the a demanding culture and how tough it is to really be good in the sport was from the class of 66. It was Bob Steenlich and Robbie Robbins and the folks that wrestled with them. At the time that we wrestled, we had, as I said, there was a separate plebe team. We had a wrestling room up on the fourth floor up near where they used to have the handball courts. And there was outside of our, where we were, the way the gym was structured in that time, there was six floors of stairs right outside our wrestling room. So we would, Ron Pfeiffer was our coach, was three-time All-American from Penn State. He'd work us out tough for about an hour and a half, and then he would, we'd go run the stairs. So all six flights, we'd do them three times, and he got us in pretty good shape. One day they decided, though, they were going to have us work out with the varsity. So we go down to the wrestling room on the first floor, and it's not where it is now. It was in the old wrestling room. And I don't know if that's, I think that was used to be, and it may still be the main entrance to the gym, but Bob Steenlich and Robbie Robbins decided to take us on a run after doing some push-ups, sit-ups, calisthenics. We go out for a run, and they took us out from the gym, took us around the plane, up Thayer Road, down to the hotel, and then we came up behind, before we get to Buffalo Soldier Field, we turned up the hill, ran up to Mikey Stadium, and then we were in the stadium steps, and then finished coming back to the room. But those guys were in front, hustling all the way, and it was pretty apparent how seriously they took the sport, and how seriously they took the conditioning for the sport. And I guess what I learned from that is that's what it takes. You may think you're working really hard, but there's always somebody who can push you harder. And I think that's a key piece to getting better.
Yes.
The shortage of places to run uphill at West Point, that's for sure.
Yeah, it definitely helped. I mean, the upperclassmen really set the tone. I mean, they have such a, you know, in every wrestling college program, it's probably like that too, a little bit, but there's such a different dynamic at West Point, you know, with being an upperclassman and the role you have over, you know, the plebes when they come in. And so as upperclassmen, if they really take that conditioning perspective, you know, conditioning, you know, in the preseason, that really builds the rest of the, you know, the rest of the younger guys to really understand the demands.
And for me, that was an upperclassman. What was most important was the example. I know in Bob Steenlich's interview, he talked about how, you know, he didn't like the way this plebe system was handled, and he didn't mistreat Pleeps, and that was always my experience with him. We were teammates. But, you know, there was, you know, I had enormous respect for he and Robbie, not just because of what they had achieved, but because how hard they worked to get there. And they treated all of us, all the plebes, with dignity and respect all the time. They would kick our butts, but they would do it in a respectful and dignified way.
Was that unanimous across the wrestling program, or like were there some upperclassmen on the team that like mistreated plebes?
I have the best memory of Bob Steenlitz and Robbie. I sat on Robbie's table in the mess hall for a couple of cycles, so I got to know him better. But especially watching them, get ready for the nationals. When Bob had won the Easterns as a cow, and then he lost to Joe Peratorian as a senior, and he decided to go down to 123 and to wrestle the nationals. And seeing those guys get ready for that. And I think, you know, certainly the other members of 66 were on the team, and the other class of 67, 68. Roger Hyman, the captain from class of 67. In those days, they didn't have co-captains. It was one captain elected by the team. So Bob Steenlitz, Roger Hyman was 67. He was, when I beat him in the wrestle-off, it could have been a very uncomfortable situation. I was a yearling. He was a senior. He's his team captain. I'm taking him out of the lineup. And he was a model of professionalism and a great teammate. And as it turned out, I was injured at the end of the season. I had a blood clot in my leg. So I missed the Navy match and missed the Easterns, but he wrestled in the Easterns and took third in the East. And then I took third the next 2 years. So Army owned 160.
That's right.
Third place at 160 for those 3 years. I think there was still a little bit of, because we were not in a college environment, you know, there was kind of a temptation to kind of break loose, you know, get out of your uniform when you go to tournaments or to other things. And sometimes I think we were not as careful on that as we should have been. I think we were too eager to get out, not to show the flag. One thing that impressed me about Navy wrestlers was that they were always in uniform. They had a letter sweater that they could wear that was much more comfortable than running, walking around in your dress gray.
Practically pajamas. Is what they were probably wearing.
Well, no, not really. It was a very professional looking uniform. You know, it was instead of wearing their what would have been their blouse, they had the letter sweater over it. And it I like that. I thought that was very well done and we didn't always do that.
So we haven't really dived into the plebe team. So who was it? Did you guys practice with the rest of the teams, or was it a separate entity?
We were in a separate room. There was a restroom for the plebes up on the fourth floor. Occasionally we would get together with the varsity, but pretty much they kept us separate. And I don't think there was any, I think it was a matter of space. They wanted to try to, I think the thought in those days is, try to get as many guys, who could contribute on the plebe team, so that you have, a better selection, because the prep school program was not what it is today. So if you're looking, that's kind of a development year for you if you're trying to, and all the sports were that way. Football team, they had a plebe football team, and that's a good screening device for the your potential varsity A squad wrestlers, football players, and so on.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was always curious. Dr. Bantz would bring that up about the plebe team. And I always thought, like, who was the coach of it? So was it like a second lieutenant who stayed behind? Did he coach the plebe team, or was it something different? Is it something that
actually different? When I first went back to when I got back from Vietnam, I was I was an inpatient. I was wounded and inpatient in Vietnam, and in Vietnam for about for 2 weeks, and then I went to Japan for 2 weeks, and then I was another week inpatient in St. Albans in New York, and then I was an outpatient for about 5 months. And when I went back to duty, because I'd been up to West Point in the meantime, and I'd seen Coach Alitz, and he was looking for an opportunity to get me up to West Point. Because I could, he thought I, you know, in any capacity, I could still help out with the program. And initially one.
All right. Sorry about the technical difficulties there, but, Mr. Nardotti, if you could, you know, please continue about talking about the different, the Plebe wrestling team and kind of how things were different a little bit then, and how you guys wrestled in different rooms than the wrestling team, and kind of just continue your thoughts there.
Well, basically we were, although we were separate, we certainly felt like we were part of the wrestling team, West Point's wrestling team. But just that we were like everybody, all the other plebe organizations, we certainly were an A squatter. So that's just the way it was in those days. And I think it was a useful vehicle to get people trained up for the tougher years of competition. It was still, when I went back to coach at West Point to teach wrestling and coach, they still had, this is 1971, 72. They still had separate plebe teams. And I was the plebe wrestling coach during those years. And basically, jumping from my plebe experience to when I coached, you know, we just tried to follow as much as possible the varsity model in terms of how we worked on our conditioning and also how we worked on technique. Even then, when I was coaching the team, there was limited opportunity to get both teams together. But I think we did it more at that time than we did when I was actually on the plebe team.
Nice. So, I mean, kind of, you know, as you look back on your time, you know, wrestling at West Point, are there any things that's like stand out, you know, before we kind of move into your next chapter? You know, I know you talked a lot about kind of, you know, what West Point and wrestling has taught you. But if you want to, you know, kind of final thoughts on there before we, you know, hit on your military. Well,
when I was a senior, when I was a firstie, John Dinger, captain of our team, and Greg Smith, they were also seniors. And we were disappointed. You know, we wound up second in the Easterns. We didn't have any Eastern champs. Greg Smith probably should have been. It was horribly officiated match, his final match. But we came in second in the Easterns to Navy. And we'd said to Coach Alitz, as the season was over, you know, we said, we're sorry we didn't do better. We really hoped we could bring the title home to you. And he said, the way that Leroy Alitz, he said, that's okay. You're going to do more important things. And he said that, and it wasn't just a throwaway line. It was something he really meant. And in the years that follows, I could certainly understood what he meant. It wasn't 18 months later, I was leading troops in Vietnam. And I'm confident that my experience, what I learned in wrestling, the disciplines that I had to apply, basically the sticking to it in difficult times was something that was important in my leadership development. So I have always fully appreciated that. And I'll tell you one other thing. Jay Robinson was, who's previously had been, I don't know how long ago this was, not that long ago, was the coach at Minnesota. He'd been assistant to Dan Gable at IFO for a number of years. He used to run camps up at Minnesota, and he'd have, he said the Navy SEALs would come by his camp to see if there were any possibilities of people at wrestlers that they might recruit. And he said they told him the best candidates for SEAL training were swimmers, of course, and wrestlers, because of the discipline of the sport. And I think that I've always looked back on that as something that is in some respects unique about the sport, that what it takes in terms of individual determination and ability to pick yourself up off the mat when you haven't done as well as you'd like to and drive on to do better. So I think that, you know, and that discipline is, you know, continued even into my professional life. Not that I have wrestled anybody to them. I mean, I've been tempted in law that if logic and reason don't work, perhaps two out of three falls will, but I hadn't had to resort to that in my legal practice. But the fact that I had wrestled was a big deal to some of my partners, that's for sure. And there was actually here in DC a wrestlers business network of executives and others who had wrestling experience, and they were trying to encourage wrestling here in DC.
Yeah, that's a good concept. There's more networks like that building in different sports and different entities. I've known across, you know, we had Matt Marciniak on here before, and he's involved in a golf network. Sounds kind of similar, not similar in intensity, but similar in the network yeah. Environment. But you know, kind of moving past West Point a little bit, you know, and gearing up into, you know, you go into Vietnam. You mentioned similarities between, you know, the demands of wrestling and the demands of Ranger School. Talk to us a little bit, you know, about your preparation for Ranger School and, you know, how you, you know, I feel like, you know, what it sounds like it's kind of like preparation before a match a little bit, where, you know, you're going to Vietnam, this is your pinnacle training environment, you know, so talk to us a little bit about that and how that prepared you for Vietnam specifically.
Well, in those days when you graduated, you had 60 days leave. And I tried to not let myself deteriorate spend 60 days at the beach, but we had a good training rotation in preparation for Ranger School, because we showed up in August and went to airborne school first. So we were, you know, we were going through the rigors of airborne school, which was actually helped us get ready for Ranger School itself. And then, of course, once you get into Ranger School, you're, you know, the physical aspects of it are on a, you know, continual, you're being continually put to the test. So basically that, you know, the preparation was, I knew I was going to go to airborne school first. So I had, as long as I didn't show up to airborne school completely deteriorated, which was not going to happen, that was going to be a good prep for Ranger School itself. And then just have to put your nose to the grindstone and meet the demands of Ranger School. Robbie Robbins actually was on the cadre at the Ranger School when I was there. He was in the Florida Ranger camp. So he was there at the very end. And one of the things he said after we concluded, he said, this, for many of you, this may be the most demanding physical undertaking you've had in your life. You're probably in the best shape of your life, which I think was true at that time. But I think in addition to the physical shape, the confidence and the mental shape that we needed going forward was very important. When I went to Vietnam, I was the only person in the company I was the only West Point graduate. I was the only Ranger in the company. I went in a helicopter assault unit, and most of the officers were pilots. But that put me in kind of a unique situation.
Gotcha. So, you know, I'd love for you to share some of your story. I know your time in Vietnam was short, you know, because of some, you know, activity and engagements you were in. If you could talk to us a little about that. I know you were, you know, inducted into the Ranger Hall of Fame in 2006. So, you know, really like to hear, you know, some stories. I think a lot of, you know, younger classmates like myself and Jordan, you know, don't understand, you know, we've only seen really in movies, kind of what Vietnam was like, kind of, you know, giving us some perspective, you know, maybe, you know, what your true experience there was like, when you're entering and kind of getting into theater yourself.
Well, the Vietnam experience is different than what you currently see in the Army. Today, when the Army, when they deploy, they generally deploy in units. So you're going with a group of people that you've trained with, most of whom, you know, you probably know pretty well. In those days for Vietnam, you went to the replacement detachment and you went out individually to fill spaces that the vacancies that had been up. So you weren't necessarily going to go with anybody that you wouldn't go with anybody that you necessarily trained with you. My classmates and I were scattered to the kind of to the four winds. I had asked to go to the, you know, I asked for the infantry to be commissioned in the infantry. I requested that. I had all choices. I graduated high enough that I could have choices. And then I selected infantry as the branch. In those days, it wasn't, given Vietnam, it wasn't the most sought after branch. People at the bottom of the class generally, you know, were going to go infantry, not by choice, but that's what was left. I think it's that tendency is, I believe, is reversed today. And they generally run out of infantry spots. But when I went to got to Vietnam, I was in the replacement detachment. I actually got a phone call from somebody on the staff of the 1st Cavalry Division. I let me backstep a minute. You know, you even though you you pick your branch and then you get to pick your unit of assignment. I volunteered for Vietnam and I volunteered to go to the first cab. But that was going to be, that was almost 18 months before I actually went. You know, I think we were all under the illusion that what we chose, we were going to get. You know, you learn later that it's the needs of the Army are going to dictate that. So it happened, I was kind of fortuitous that when I went to Vietnam, that I got a call from somebody on the personnel staff, a major who had been at West Point when I was a cadet there. He recognized my name and he called me up and said, you know, I got a, they said, call the personnel director. And I called him. He said, how'd you like to be a blue platoon leader? And I said, I heard platoon leader. And I said, of course, no, that's what I want to be a platoon leader. And when I got off the phone, I said, some guy was behind me in line at the phone. He said, I said to him, what's a blue platoon leader? And he went like that, give me an indication that I was probably stepping into something that was going to be on the high end of the risk scale. And when I got to the unit, I found out my two immediate predecessors had been carried out on stretchers. So it was a unit that had seen quite a bit of action, and that was not going to slow down. I was very fortunate in that we were a helicopter assault company. We were the infantry platoon for a helicopter assault company. So it was mainly pilots. We had our own pilots, our own ships. And it wasn't like we were being shuttled around by pilots who were from another unit, and somebody might drop you off and then somebody else might pick you up. Our guys dropped us off and they come in and get us. And we knew that they would, if there was, if we were knee deep in something, they'd find a way to get to us. We had our own gunships that were part of the lash up for the unit. When I got to the unit, the one concern I had, my platoon sergeant wasn't that much older. He was on his second tour to Vietnam, so he was a veteran. He'd been with the unit for a while. But in a situation that I described where you're an individual replacement, you know, when you come in like that, you are the, you know, you're the new guy. You're the guy with least experience in the whole platoon. And I was with the unit for about a month or so. And things were going okay. We were, you know, going through a number of operations, everything worked well. And my platoon sergeant said to me one day, he said, well, how do you like being with the blue platoon? I said, I'm thrilled to be here, but I said, I'm the new guy. And I'm not sure how that you know, how that sits with all these guys that have been here quite a bit longer. And he said, don't you worry about it. He said, first of all, when the shooting starts, they're going to turn to you. You're the platoon leader. And he said, also, you know, you're the only West Pointer in this unit. And he said, you better believe that they're really proud that they got a West Point lieutenant who's who's leading them. Yeah. So that was kind of an eye opener for me. I will tell you one amusing story. There was a guy, one of the guys, and I'll tell you that other than my platoon sergeant, the guys in my platoon were 17 to 19 years old. Mm. I was 23. So there were, you know, I've talked to some high school, you know, high school classes about the Vietnam experience. And when I tell them, you know, the guys in my platoon were 17 to 19 years old. How many of you, if it's a younger group, how many of you have brothers in high school? That's the kind of guys that not too much older were with me in Vietnam. But there was one of the guys was an M60 gunner. He's a good sized guy, good athlete. And he heard I was a wrestler. And he, the platoon, we had a great relationship. They always referred to me as Blue because I was the Blue platoon leader, or LT. That was it. And this one guy, Ken Hargrove, who was a sergeant and M60 gunner, well built, would poke at me every once in a while. I said, "Hey, Blue, I understand you're a wrestler." He said, "Son, one of these days we're going to have to go at it, just you and me, and see who comes out on top." And I said, okay, Hargrove. And he kind of was poking at me on a regular basis. And one day we put down, we had a little bit of time to kill. So I said, "Okay, Hargrove, now's your chance." So we, the platoon circled us, and there we were in the dirt wrestling, and I tied him in knots pretty quickly. And that went a long way to cementing my relationship with the platoon and with Sergeant Hargrove. I mean, the fact that I was willing to grapple with him was a big deal, and the fact that I tied him in knots was a bigger deal.
So. I think you'd be hard pressed to find an Army wrestling alumni that hasn't had a similar experience with people too. I love it. That's awesome.
Oh, that's funny. I'm thinking about mine as you're telling that story. It really shed some light on just kind of how like some things never really change in the military over time. But that's really cool. I mean, if you could dive into a little bit about, you know, your, you know, the actions that brought you, where you got injured and you had to come back to the States, because I know you were only in Vietnam for 3 months. You know, if you could share that story, I'm sure our listeners would love to hear it.
We, as I mentioned, we were an air assault unit, and we were expected to, we were a quick response unit. We could get off. In fact, they had us really outside the wire of the fire base where we were located, so we could get off the ground pretty quickly. We had three UH-1s. Each could carry seven. Unless we were going to rappel in to a location, if we couldn't land the helicopters, had a rappel in, they'd only take six. Because the pilots said with the extra weight, if you had seven bodies in there and you're trying to rappel it, that would be very difficult. So that happened to be key on the day that we went into, we were called in to support a Ranger team. The Ranger teams in those days, as I mentioned earlier, they were not the Ranger battalions that were stood up in the mid 70s. They were long range reconnaissance, and they were out there to recon. They were not out there to get into fights. But if they stumbled into something unintended, and you know, there's only four of them, and they would need help right away, and the air assault units, like the one that I was in, the helicopter assault units, our platoon was intended just for that purpose, because we could get in. And this is before the days of aerosol training where they gave you the badge for it. We learned how to rappel out of helicopters in Vietnam. And we got a call one day. It was late in the day. We'd already had one action earlier in the day, which didn't amount to a whole lot, but we had an action earlier in the day. But we got a call about 4:30 saying there's a Ranger team in trouble, and bounced the Blues. That was the express. Blues got to get out and get them. They said not going to be able to land. So we had to drop three people. We had to go in with 18 instead of normally we would have 21 go in, but since we were rappelling in, we could only go in with 18. We were told that this might be a hot LZ. It might take fire going in. It didn't turn out to be the case. That would have had the hair standing on the back of our necks if that had been the case, but we were able to get in as close as we could to rappel in. And we weren't going to be on top of the action. We would have to make our way to the Ranger. So we got out. It was, as I said, it was about 4:30. By the time we got out there, we rappelled in. We were able to make our way through and linked up with the Rangers. The Ranger team leader was out in front, about 10 meters from the three other guys he had who were formed a kind of a semi-perimeter, as much as three guys could form. And and we had heard, they told us they were taking rockets and heavy machine gun fire. We could hear the fire when we were flying in, but when we got to the made the link up with the Rangers, the firing had stopped. But the Ranger team leader was about 10 meters out in front. I crawled out to him. We're both in the prone position. I asked him, give me the scoop. And he described, he saw it was a dug-in platoon. Wasn't sure how many they had there, but they had fired some rockets and they had heavy machine guns. He said to me, this is a hell of a position for a short timer to be in. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term, but in Vietnam, short timer was somebody who was, under 30 days.
Yeah.
I said, how short are you? And he said, 9 days. And just then, we were just probably maybe 4 or 5 inches apart, shoulder. We're both in the prone position. My radio operator taps me on the boot. And I look back and he said, Saber 6, who was our troop commander, was on the horn. So I turned, I'm in the prone position. I turned to reach the handset. And that's just when a rocket went off above us to the front. I took shrapnel to the neck. The Ranger, who was shoulder to shoulder, took shrapnel in the head. My voice box was shattered, and so I couldn't talk. I was kind of whispering. And I was bleeding. I looked at him, and he was in very bad shape. But I was bleeding. I thought I might begin to choke. I crawled back to get wrapped by the by our medic. And then I said, somebody's got to come out and help me get him back in. So one of the other guys and I crawled out and we were pulling him back in. And then I took a bullet in the arm, an AK round in the arm. We were able to get him back the 10 yards. And I was, through my whisper, my heavy whisper, I said to the aircraft above us, I said, we got a critical. The Ranger's critical. We gotta break contact and get him out. I also had one other guy who took a bullet in the shoulder. I had the shrapnel wound, and I had the wound to the arm. Fortunately, the round that I took to the arm went in the bone. It shattered the radius and ulna, but the bullet stayed there. I can, even though I can't, I still can't turn this I can't supinate this hand. I can't, that's as far as I can turn this hand. I can't turn palm up. But I was consider myself fortunate because if the bullet had gone through, I probably would have lost most of my forearm. So by this time, it's about 8:30 at night, dark. And they sent in, we're trying to break contact. And we've got, we had our three aircraft were in the air. We had two sets of Cobras, three each, are in the air, 369. And then there was, we had the commander and a couple of other birds in the air. There were like 15 aircraft in the air in the dark. And they were providing, you know, they provided close air support, mostly machine guns because we were, the Gatling guns because the we were too close for rockets. We had some rockets in, but it was very close, and we had to create some distance before they could really use the rockets. They dropped in another group of Blues from the 17th Cav that were going to link up with us to get us to a medevac site. And that's trying to do a night link up in the jungle is very risky business. You know, you might wind up shooting each other if you're not careful. We're able to do that to make contact without killing each other. But the medevac, you know, there was no place close to get a medevac in to land. So the medevac told the other aircraft, you got to clear some space so I can get in. He came in and he dropped a cable down, and they dropped one of those, it was a kind of a cocoon that we could put the ranger. Ranger was unconscious. And they did a kind of the Velcro wrap. It was like a mummy. It was like they were pulling up a mummy into the aircraft. And then they dropped T-bars down for me and the other wounded troop. Took us to Long Bend. This is about 8:30 at night. They took us to Long Bend. They took us to the nearest fire base. And it was kind of surreal. It was kind of, I don't know if you ever saw the program MASH, which is in Korea, where they have the helicopter landing and everybody running in it. Yeah. We're coming into the end of the fire base, and around the helipad, there's a bunch of people in uniforms and white smocks and other things. And but this is interesting. And I really wasn't processing what was going on. As soon as we hit the ground, we had people rushing the helicopter from all sides. They took all of us out, cleaned our wounds as much as they could. They put in IVs and had us back in the bird in 5 minutes. And we're on the way to Long Bend. And we got to Long Bend Hospital, and we all went into surgery. The next day, I had the two doctors. I had one doctor that pulled the shrapnel out of my neck, and I also had shrapnel in the back, which I didn't know. So I was, I had to wrap around my neck, but I was actually losing blood. I had more blood than I really realized. One of my compatriots another lieutenant saw me come into the fire base. He said, well, you were gray when you got off that helicopter, which I think back later that's a really dangerous situation to be in where you're losing blood. You're not conscious of how serious the situation is.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next day, the two doctors who did the surgery, one on the neck, one on the arm, came by to see me. And I asked, the first thing I asked was, what about the Ranger? And he didn't make it. his name was Omer, O-M-E-R, Bryce Carson from Tennessee. Hadn't reached his 19th birthday. This was December 6th. He would have been 19, I think, on December 19th. His company commander, the Ranger company commander, troop commander, came to see me in the hospital. I knew him. I had had an intern assignment at Fort Carson before I went to Vietnam. And I had met the company commander there. So he came to see me in the hospital, and he said, his mother, Carson's mother, had written to him and asked him, had begged him to take her son out of the field because she had another son that she lost in Vietnam. And the company commander, Frank Stewart, said he went to Carson, said he wanted to take him out of the field, and Carson said, no, I want to stay till the end. And he said, I honored his decision, and now I have to live with mine. Not even 19. And I was the last one to speak to him. I think the age that had the highest number of casualties in Vietnam was 20, and the 19-year-olds weren't far behind. But I was really fortunate, even with this hand. I mean, I'm right-handed, so it's not a big deal. I think you had asked in one of your questions whether this had any bearing on my later decision to go into the JAG Corps. I can't say the injury drove it, but basically I had a permanent 2 profile from then on. And if I wanted it, they said no airborne, because in those days if you're going to do airborne, if you're going to steer the chute, you got to be able to grab the risers from the front and the side and the back. And I didn't have full range. So they said I wouldn't be able to do that. But I was, I mentioned before that the guys that were my platoon were 17 to 19 years old. And they're the ones that got me out. I mean, I made the decision, let's break contact, let's get to the medevac site. But basically these guys made sure that they had to carry this Ranger out. And they had to, there was an E5. My platoon sergeant wasn't with us that day. So this young E5 was the guy that was really, I said, you gotta lead us out of here. He did. And I have lived to tell the tale.
But those certainly aren't easy things to always share. So thank you for sharing your story with us. And doesn't always do justice, but thank you for your service. You know, I think our country hasn't done a great job of thanking our Vietnam veterans, unfortunately. So appreciate what you did over there. And, I can tell your passion about just the young lives that unfortunately were lost right in the war. But to your previous point, I think your comment was, you don't regret any of the things. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you had made a comment about, you served valorously and courageously and did what was asked and called upon of you. So thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. Appreciate you sharing.
You know, they one of the things I should mention to you is about the West Point experience that drove home just what we had gotten into by going to West Point was there were guys that I saw on the athletic field play football or something else. I also saw buried at West Point during that 4-year period. I think Bob Steenlitz mentioned Bob Arvin, who's Arvin Jim is named after.
Yeah.
I actually saw him wrestle. I saw the match that Bob described where he wrestled Mike Caruso and beat Caruso handily 7-2. And Bob Arvin was was on that team. When Bob Arvin was killed in action in 1967. So we brought him home while we were there, and the guys in 68 were plebes when he was there. So it was really tough for the team. But it was tough for everybody to see the level of sacrifice. This is off wrestling, but it kind of still on the point. There was a Catholic priest at West Point at the time when we were there. At the time, they did not have military chaplains. They had the Catholic chapel was manned by the New York Archdiocese. And there was a young priest by the name of Edwin O'Brien who was there all 4 years with our class. And he was in the New York Archdiocese. So he, after his tour there, he could have gone back to the city, and he knew the bishop, the cardinal that was down there. So he could have done that easily enough. But instead of that, he volunteered for the Army chaplaincy, volunteered for Airborne, and he went to the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Vietnam. And then when the 173rd stood down, so he would come home early, but the chaplain from the first cab had been there longer, so he switched positions with that chaplain so the other guy could come home earlier. And somebody asked him years later, why did you do that? You could have gone back to the New York Archdiocese, and instead you volunteer for the chaplaincy, and you airborne, and you do all that, and you volunteer for Vietnam. And he said, in the 4 years that he was at West Point, there were cadets that he had married and that he also buried at West Point. And he said, when you see that level of sacrifice, you just can't stand by. You got to do something. And he did. And he's a cardinal today. It's Cardinal Edwin O'Brien. he as an archbishop, he was the archbishop for the military services for 10 years. And then he became the cardinal and the archbishop of Baltimore, and then was made a cardinal in 2012. Mm-hmm. Cardinal emeritus today. He's cardinal, but he's in an emeritus status. He's because he's over 80 years old. But that's, I think that captures the feeling at that time of the depth of the meaning of service. What you're seeing, and I'm sure that for the classes that went through that I saw, may have seen the same thing and over the time for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, same thing. That they were athletes that you saw on the athletic field and then came back to their final resting place.
Yeah, I can just imagine. It didn't even click to me that that Bob Arvin, his death happened while you were cadets. Just thinking back, when I was at the academy, There was a lot of names that came over the poop deck, but I didn't know any of them, and none of them were wrestlers. I never had a tight bond with any of the class while I was at the academy. So I didn't really think about that, and I'm sure that hits a lot differently while you're at the academy when it's one of the guys you were competing with the year or two before.
Yeah. After your time in Vietnam, you made a significant transition and moved into the JAG Corps, obviously had a long and successful career in that, and then moved into private practice. What was some of your reasons for doing that? Was that just to continue your service despite, some of the injuries and things you just discussed, or did you have a general interest in that as a young age?
Actually, no, it's actually a bit funny. When I was a firstie, the practice at that time was any of the academic departments where you did reasonably well would talk to you about coming back to the academy, and a couple of departments that expressed some interest. But I remember talking to somebody about this, because we were briefed on, they said the only postgraduate education that the Army wouldn't pay for was law. And I remember saying to myself, what idiot would go to law school to be a JAG when you have to pay your own way. Well, 4 years later, that's what I was doing. I was paying my own way to go to law school. What led me to that was the Army was in very bad shape in those days. I had been at in a stateside unit. If you volunteered for Vietnam in those days, the mortality rate of lieutenants, the second lieutenants, was high enough that they said, you need some seasoning. You need to be with a stateside unit at least 4 to 6 months. So I had to I went to Fort Carson to the 5th Mechanized Infantry for about 8 months before I went to Vietnam. And it was really not a good experience. I mean, it was the soldiers I worked with. I actually got to command a company out there for a short time. While I was a second lieutenant when this happened. And that's how hard up we were for officers in those days. They were drained off to Vietnam. And my company commander called me in and said, congratulations, you're going to take command of this company when I leave for Vietnam. But he said, before you get too big ahead, you just remember that you should know that the only reason you're getting this command is because we've got enough good NCOs here to take care of you, keep you out of trouble. I was 22, I guess. I hadn't turned 23 yet. The first sergeant had been in the Army for 26 years, was a veteran of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. And a bunch of the other NCOs were, you know, similar, you know, most of them were veterans of two wars, at least Korea and Vietnam. So that's the kind of situation that it was great to have those kind of mentors. But the situation was really pretty bad because they all the money was going into Vietnam and we couldn't train, couldn't get fuel. It was a mechanized infantry unit. We couldn't get parts. I think we had in the entire 8 months, we went out for one field exercise and it was, we were flirting with disaster because of the, you know, maintenance was very tough under those circumstances. And when I got back from Vietnam, the Army was really going through a very difficult time. They were putting people out. There was a reduction in force. a lot of people were being let go who didn't want to be let go. The NCO Corps essentially had been broken because they had been sending good NCOs back to Vietnam. And finally, you know, a lot of them said, we're not doing this anymore. So you had an NCO Corps that was broken, that had to be rebuilt. The Army was trying to, you know, resurrect itself after the what had happened in Vietnam and the damage that had done to the Army. So there was a great temptation at that point to look in other directions. Now, but I can't say that that's what led me to the JAG Corps. I did meet some attorneys at some JAGs at Fort Carson. And I got enough of a picture of the, and they were very, you know, they were all great attorneys. They came from good schools. But what I noticed about the JAG Corps was that there were a lot of, the young guys were getting out. There weren't too many you know, captains that, certainly that, I didn't see any, but they were lawyers. They had not had combat experience. And what had occurred to me was that, you know, if I went to law school, I was would be in kind of a unique position that I had been a platoon leader, I'd been a company commander, I'd been in combat, and I'm also a lawyer. So I felt that, you know, I'd been a soldier, now I'm a lawyer, and I thought I would have credibility with commanders that perhaps other, you know, just lawyers would not have. And that paid dividends, more dividends than I could explain. I had, rightly or wrong, I had immediate credibility with commanders if I'd, you know, go in and talk to them about how they would deal with a problem case. And I think that's helped me throughout my career. I think what I'd probably be remembered most for as the Army JAG was, I emphasized the need to be soldiers as well as good lawyers. In fact, I said at my swearing in, I said, we're not lawyers who happened to wear uniforms were soldiers who happened to be lawyers. There were always some good soldiers in the JAG Corps. They were there. What was different at the time I became the JAG was that nobody had said that from the top. Nobody at the top said it's important. Soldiering is important. If you want to take care of your clients, you need to understand their hardship. You need to understand what they're going through. Now, not everybody can be in the infantry before you become a JAG, but I always used to tell when I spoke at virtually every basic course graduation of the new JAGs coming in, and I said, one, you have to understand these are people who are direct commissions coming right out of law school to be lawyers and to be judge advocates. And I said, you need to understand what you don't know. You need to know what you don't know, which is you don't know soldiering. And the best advice I can give you is to latch on to your good NCOs, listen to what they have to tell you. They are more than willing to help you. If you're too proud to get help, that's going to be your problem. If you're not too proud, if you're willing to ask and listen and learn, they're not going to let you walk off the cliff. If you're an ass about it, they will. And we beat the drum very loudly on that, and that's still a point of great pride with the Army JAGs is these are soldiers that happen to be lawyers. So that's as I said, that turned out better than I could have ever expected. And for the entire time, the fact that when I was on the Army staff, there were only a couple of us who were Vietnam veterans at that point. Chief of staff was one and the JAG, that's kind of odd. And maybe one or two.
That's definitely unique.
Yeah. So, I'm sure that made a difference later too. The fact that I had been a platoon leader in Vietnam made a difference. Rightly or wrongly, it made a difference.
Definitely a unique background. You don't see very many Ranger lawyers, that's for sure.
We actually have a Ranger lawyer who's a current, I'm already forgetting his name. He was a graduate in 02, but he was an infantry officer, Ranger qualified, and then went JAG.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
I'm blanking on his name, but he's still in the military now, but really interesting. Jordan, what else you got?
Well, you talked about Robbie Robbins being somebody that would be a cool individual or a good guest at some point. Is there anybody else that comes to mind that we need to course to get on here?
I have to think more. I've been thinking about that. I think it's really what Bob said last time or during his interview. That's the only class. That's a class that had three All-Americans in it. And I think that alone, you got to talk to those guys. Yeah. Bob is the captain. That's a great one. But Robbie, winning the Easterns and being a two-time All-American, he was a good guy and a leader by example.
Well, we'll have to track him down and get him on the show.
Yeah, I'll have to check the database. I think the database is pretty in depth. Mm-hmm. So we may already have his contact, but I'll reach out to Mr. Seenlidge as well. Jordan and I need to reach out to him too. We haven't talked to him in a good bit, but we spent a few hours on the phone with him through the years. Mm-hmm. I'll listen to some of his stories. He's a great man.
Yes.
Awesome. Anything to add or parting words, before we close this out? Really appreciate you coming on.
No, I think, I've talked to you long enough. I'm sorry for going on like this, but
the longer the better. Honestly, we don't get enough of, the experiences, from, folks really, from even in the, the 80s or the, the 70s. So, the more we can hear from you and learn from you, the greater it is for us.
Well, I really appreciate you reaching back for some of the old guys. I'm just really impressed with what's going on today in the Army wrestling program. I really have great respect for Kevin Ward and what he's doing and what I'm seeing with the team, and just got to get another one back from Navy this year.
Yeah,
disappointment not to get that one last year and the last couple of years, but like to see them. And I'm glad to see that they have more duels this year. I know they did a lot of wrestling last year, but they had a limited number of duel meets, and I think that's important to them. So it looks like they got a really full schedule.
So. Yeah, they've got a very tough schedule. It's not as, I think it's not as demanding as it was last year as far as the top teams in the country, but it's still very tough. Definitely, they'll get a lot of experience from national qualifier type of individuals.
Yeah. Well, hopefully I'll see you guys at something, either at an Army Navy I'll be at the American University one this year, but maybe one of the things up at West Point, we'll get to see you guys.
Yeah, fantastic. Awesome. Well, appreciate you hopping on. This was a lot of fun tonight. No, really, really, really appreciate it. So,
okay.
Jordan, sir, have a good night.
Thanks very much, Brian. Thanks, Jordan.
Great to meet you.
Good to meet you too.
Thanks for tuning in to the B-Haw Radio Show. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe and leave us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. If there's something you'd like to hear on a future show, reach out to us on any of our social media, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter. Or you can reach us at email, bhaw.radio@gmail.com. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and as always, go Army, be Navy.